Hey ladies, Scott Horton here. If you would like truly youthful, healthy, and healthy-looking skin, there is one very special company you need to visit. Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. Dagny & Lane has revolutionized the industry with a full line of products made from organic and all-natural ingredients that penetrate deeply with nutrient-rich ionic minerals and antioxidants for healthy and beautiful skin. That's Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. And for a limited time, add promo code SCOTT15 at checkout for a 15% discount. Next guest up is Alexander Abdo, staff attorney at the National Security Program of the ACLU. Welcome to the show. Welcome back to it. We've spoken before, right?
I think we have, yeah.
Abdo, sounds familiar. Anyway, I love the ACLU, man. I'm not a lawyer, but I sure am glad that there are lawyers whose job it is to sue the government all day and try to make them stop doing things. And I know you can't win them all, but I like it when you do. I'm almost always on your side, or I perceive you to almost always be on mine anyway.
I appreciate that.
So, yeah. And there's an almost in there, but still, it's all right. Okay, so let's talk about this, the National Security Agency, and I guess whoever else, FBI and whatever other agencies, wiretapping Americans without warrants. When the story broke back in 2005, it was a really big deal. It seemed like, you know, in the media, that kind of thing. Yet since then, it's sort of the Democrats legalized it back in 2008, and there's been some challenges here and there, but, you know, it's a Democratic government in power, so a lot of the critics have kind of, you know, drifted away somewhere. And so we don't hear too much about this anymore. And yet, it did make the news, thankfully at least, that last week or 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court refused to hear a case about the warrantless wiretapping of American citizens by this government, which, you know, my junior college understanding means that's it. It stands. They might as well have ruled in favor of it. Unless they choose, you know, the next time on a different case to go ahead and hear it. This basically for the whole country means in all circuits, this is legal now for them to go ahead and tap our phones without warrants, right?
Well, that's right. You know, last week the Supreme Court ruled that the most sweeping surveillance statute that Congress has ever passed essentially cannot be challenged in court, or at least not in a public court. And that type of ruling, I think, is actually a bit more pernicious than one even upholding the constitutionality of the statute. It'd be one thing for a court or you know, the Supreme Court to exercise its obligation to say what the law is, to analyze the statute and tell us whether it's constitutional. But it's quite another for the court to say this is none of our business and that the courts will not be asked or required to analyze the constitutionality of this extremely sweeping surveillance statute. That's the type of ruling that's troubling from the perspective of a constitutional democracy, and it's one I think that should trouble all Americans, that our system of checks and balances has broken when it comes to surveillance in the years, now more than a decade since 9/11.
Yeah, so they're basically just saying, hey, this is a matter of foreign policy. And now, I'm sorry, technically speaking here, it was the FISA Amendments Act, which is the Democrats' legalization of Bush's illegal warrantless wiretapping that was passed in 08 that was at issue before the court. Is that correct?
Right. It was a 2008 statute, the FISA Amendments Act of 2008, which essentially codified and in a number of ways expanded President Bush's warrantless wiretapping program. You'll remember that program started shortly after 9/11 when the White House authorized the National Security Agency essentially to ignore the existing laws, the laws that put a judge in between the NSA and Americans' international communications. And that program was exposed by the New York Times in 2005, and shortly after the program was modified and then it was ended, but Congress, in a series of enactments starting in 2007 and then finally in 2008, essentially codified that program. It made it even broader. It authorized the NSA to engage in dragnet surveillance of our international communications. Immediately after 9/11, the NSA was ignoring the surveillance laws, but they were doing it in a more targeted way. They were still focusing their collection of communications on basically Al-Qaeda agents. Whenever an Al-Qaeda agent was talking to someone in the United States or from the United States to someone abroad, But now, with the 2008 statute, the government and the NSA in particular can acquire our international communications whenever they think they're relevant to foreign intelligence, which is a very broadly defined category, including things like foreign affairs. So things that have no connection to terrorism, to Al-Qaeda, or even to crime. They can be things simply relevant to the foreign affairs.
Okay, now on this show, obviously I basically just talked to activists like yourself, journalists from all over the world, et cetera, like that. And I basically just take it for granted, I guess. I try not to concern myself with it. But I just sort of take it for granted that if I call anybody, even just in Mexico or Canada, but if I'm calling anybody in another country, I just assume that the NSA is recording the thing and keeping it for later, no?
Well, I hope not. You know, we have a Fourth Amendment in this country that protects our right to privacy, and our constitutional rights don't end at the border. They travel with us, and they operate as constraints on the government. And so the NSA and any other branch of government is limited by the Constitution in what they can collect about U.S. persons. So, you know, this notion that once you call someone abroad, you forfeit that right, I think is one that the government has successfully used to keep judges from inquiring as to the legality of their acts. But ultimately, that's a question that needs to be decided by a court. What exactly are the contour, what are the standards that limit the NSA when it tries to engage in this type of surveillance?
Right, but, I mean, isn't the court saying that, as I think you put it, it's none of their business, that if it's all national security, it's all national security. It has nothing to do with the Constitution or the Bill of Rights at all.
Well, that wasn't quite the reasoning.
Not saying I agree with it. I'm just saying, isn't that what they're saying? No?
No, the reasoning was slightly different. They weren't saying this is some political question and it's something for the political branches to decide. They were saying that before you can challenge the system of secret surveillance, you need to be able to prove that you were actually monitored under the program. And once you can prove that, we'll adjudicate the constitutionality of the surveillance that was directed against you. Of course, that, you know, is effectively a ruling. Given that they're asking you to prove something that you can't possibly prove. They're asking you to prove the existence of secret surveillance against you, and, you know, something that you can't possibly prove because the government refuses to disclose that information. Mm-hmm. So given that ruling, it's effectively immunity from suit for the government when it comes to the NSA surveillance program.
I see. It was just they weaseled out of it based on standing, in other words.
That's exactly right.
I'm sorry. I guess I had just assumed for some reason and thought that I'd read that this was the case where the NSA had accidentally turned over the transcript of their illegal tap, and so they were busted and standing had been proven. But that was a different case, I guess.
That was a different case. There was a case in California where lawyers argued that the government had turned over to them accidentally proof that their communications, I believe with their clients, had been picked up. The government said that information is classified as a state secret. You can't rely on it. And the courts agreed and so prevented those lawyers from relying on that document. And they didn't otherwise have any proof that their communications were monitored.
I see. And then, you know, I think I read something not too long ago that said that really this is a pretty new practice where maybe just in the last few decades compared to all of American history where the courts just decide that nobody ever has standing to sue over anything that comes down to their Bill of Rights, or almost never. And in a way where they basically make the Bill of Rights moot. It's a dead letter because it's way over there where this court case can't get to it, kind of thing.
Yeah, that's right. At least for the past four decades, the standing doctrine, which is, you know, this admittedly arcane legal concept, is essentially about a test of what you think the role of the judiciary should be, what you think the role of courts is. And there are some justices and judges who think that courts should have a far more limited role when it comes to policing the excesses of the political branches. And there are others who believe that the Constitution actually requires judges to be a neutral party in between the political branches and our individual rights. In other words, that the judiciary is the ultimate safeguard of our individual rights. And that tension has existed at least for the last 4 years. And the ruling last Tuesday from the Supreme Court, and it was a 5-4 decision, five justices essentially embraced this very narrow view of judicial authority, at least in the area of national security. And it's troubling because the founders of our country understood the importance of dividing power, of having a system of checks and balances, where you have three branches of government, each operating as a check on the other. Since 9/11, we've seen a distortion. One of the legs of the stool has been cut out from under the stool, and we're operating now with just two legs. And the result is an imbalance in government power and intrusions on individual liberties of citizens of this country.
Yeah. All right. Now, I think it was Senator. Well, never mind, because I don't know for sure. But one of these senators, a Democrat, I think, came out, maybe even sued about it or did a little something about it. I don't know. Anyway, point is, he was complaining that there's a secret interpretation of the Patriot Act that he said would blow everybody's socks off if you realize just how far they've gone with the letter of the law in there. And I wonder if that's more or less the same thing with all this stuff, where all these new laws really are just a brand new floor. And the FISA court, now, I mean, what they're doing is they're legalizing, under the FISA Amendments Act, the so-called FISA court, which is within the executive branch, if I understand it right, and is not really a court. They now authorize entire categories of information to be sweeped up, basically a general warrant, right? They don't call it that, but that's basically what it is, right? Go ahead and search all the emails of, and I don't know exactly how it breaks down, I don't know if you do. Is it based on this neighborhood? We want to get all the emails in this neighborhood, or tap all the telephones on that side of this city, or everybody named Jenkins east of the Mississippi River, or, you know, however they do it. But basically, there's a vast amount of information that always would have just been an off-limits fishing expedition that is no longer under the FISA amendments, correct?
That's right. You know, the FISA Amendments Act allows what we've called dragnet, and what the government in its papers has called programmatic surveillance of our international communications. So it authorizes the government to ask for and the FISA court to authorize, and it is in fact a traditional, you know, not a traditional, it's a secret court, but it is in fact what they call an Article III court as opposed to the an executive court. But it authorizes the FISA court to allow the government to collect broad swaths of our communications. There's nothing in the statute, for example, to prevent the government from asking the FISA court to allow it for an entire year to collect all communications between Afghanistan and the United States, or all communications between the UK and the United States, so long as it's trying to acquire foreign intelligence, which, as I said before, is very broadly defined. But, you know, the difficulty, though, in discussing this issue and in trying to litigate about it is that so little is actually known about how the government uses this authority and so many of its other surveillance authorities since 9/11. The senators, you know, you were talking about earlier, are Senators Wyden and Udall, who have who've been warning us for about 2 years now that there's a provision in the Patriot Act, Section 215, that is the subject of a secret interpretation that, as you said, would shock Americans. And we still, to this day, don't know what it is. There are rumors and suspicions about what it might be. But to this day, 2 years later, the government refuses to say what its legal understanding is of its of this authority that Congress gave it in the Patriot Act, which is somewhat shocking.
I was going to
say Wyden. that's the one.
Yeah. Now, I'm sorry, did I hear you right that I had it wrong? It's not an Article II court within the executive branch. It is an Article III court, the FISA court. It's just at the Justice Department building. Is that right?
Yeah. My understanding, actually, I think actually as of a year or two ago, they've moved it outside of the Justice Department building. I think it now has its own building.
Oh, okay. But it is under the judiciary and not like a parking ticket court where it's just part of the police.
That's right. And, you know, it was founded in 1978 when Congress first passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And for about 30 years, it was sitting in the Justice Department building. And I believe it was about 2 years ago they finally built its own building to avoid this, this appearance that it was sitting in the Justice Department building, which, is not a great place for a court to sit if it's trying to appear to be neutral.
Right. And, of course, they never were neutral, right? Like, the only warrant they ever turned down was for John Wong, who should have been tapped.
Well, you know, it's really difficult to assess the job that the FISA court is doing. In the entire course of their 35-year history, they've issued about 28,000 warrants. And they've turned down, I think, fewer than you could count on two hands. It's hard to know exactly what's going on, whether they're serving as a rubber stamp or whether their existence is causing the government to be more careful in its applications. We just don't know because there's so much secrecy surrounding the operations of the court and even the law that the court is applying. So, for example, we know that over the last 10 years, there have been a number of significant constitutional decisions issued by the FISA court relating to post-9/11 surveillance authority. So the warrantless wiretapping program and a few of the other, Section 215, which I mentioned, and a few of the other surveillance programs that have taken place since 9/11, but they are all entirely secret. We know of their existence because they've been mentioned in hearings before the Congress and by executive officials, but we just don't know what they say, which deprives us of the information we need as Americans to make sure our government is doing the job we elected it to do and to make sure that the programs are lawful, consistent with our values, and effective. And without that very basic information, it's hard to do our jobs.
Well, and as time goes on, these things just get normalized and we just move on. I mean, the FISA Amendments Act, you mentioned how or the original FISA Act, you mentioned how it was passed back in 78, and that was a big backlash from Watergate and the Church Committee hearings that revealed, you know, all these CIA dirty tricks and illegal spying on activists and all these things. And that thing's actually a criminal statute, right? Like when Bush came out the day after the New York Times story broke in December of 2005 and gave that press conference the next day and said, yeah, I did it, and what are you going to do about it? He was actually confessing to millions of felony counts of warrantless illegal wiretapping.
Well, it's true that, you know, the original statute, when it was passed and as it existed in 2001, criminalized illegal wiretapping. And unfortunately, the reaction of Congress when this unlawful program was revealed was instead of investigating how this could have come to happen, how our intelligence agency could come to engage in wide-scale illegal wiretapping of Americans' communications, the reaction was to codify it, to put it into law, and to immunize those who cooperated with the government as part of the program. That's what happened in 2008, and that's what's so troubling. And I think, you know, at the beginning of our show, you kind of alluded to the politics of this decision. You know, in 2005, when the program was exposed, many Americans were, you know, rightly concerned about the excessive authority that President Bush was claiming, whether to interrogate suspected terrorists using harsh interrogation techniques and torture, or whether to monitor Americans' communications without going to a court. Now, a few years later, we have a different president, one who is a constitutional law scholar, who has effectively kept in place many, if not most, of President Bush's national security policies, and people are less concerned. And, you know, what troubles me about the shift in attitude is that the constraints on government power are not about any one president. It doesn't matter whether it's President Obama, President Bush, if it had been President Romney or another president. What matters is the institutional restraints, the restraints on the presidency, not any one president. And without those types of meaningful restraints that last beyond any one administration, there's always a chance that a future administration will abuse the trust of the American public. And that's a very real danger. And I think that people should ask themselves, how would I react? This is how, you know, how we do our work day to day. How would we react if any number of politicians exercised the authority that the government claims today? Would we be comfortable with anyone exercising that authority, or would we be suspicious? And if it's the latter, I think it speaks to the need for more effective restraints than are currently in place.
Yeah. Well, and you know, geez, I hate to appeal to fear and all that, but I imagine just, you know, 10 years out from now, it'll have been 20 years of this, right? 15 years of knowing about it and allowing it to continue on. And by then, it'll just be the way things are now. Just like all the cameras on our street corner, just like our cops dressing up like right-wing paramilitary death squads all day and doing their dynamic entry SWAT raids on law-abiding citizens, and 100 a day, I think it is now. And on and on, right? It already pretty much, I hate to admit, seems like it has become a fixture. It is part of the American system now, and it seems like the Supreme Court has really just poured a lot of water. It's going to take another major case to break to start the whole process over again to even try to get this reviewed, right? And then even then, I fear what they're going to say, you know?
You know, I at times share your cynicism, but I try to take an optimistic view, and it's historically been the case in this country, for understandable reasons, that in times of crisis, we overreact. And it has historically always been the case that in the years or decades after those overreactions, we've come to recognize our mistakes, to regret the overreaction, and to try to put in place protections that'll stop it from happening the next time. And I still have hope that we have yet to see that recalibration of our politics to be more in line with our values. And I think we'll get there. We're quite obviously not there yet, but I have hope we'll get there.
All right. Thanks very much for your time, Alex. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, everybody. That is Alexander Abdo, staff attorney, National Security Program of the ACLU. Man, you need some Liberty stickers for the back of your truck. At LibertyStickers.com, they've got great state hate, like Pearl Harbor was an inside job. The Democrats want your guns. U.S. Army, die for Israel. Police brutality, not just for black people anymore. And government school, why you and your kids are so stupid. Check out these and 1,000 other great ones at LibertyStickers.com. And of course, they'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out WallStreetWindow.com. It's a financial blog written by former hedge fund manager Mike Swanson, who's investing in commodities, mining stocks, and European markets. Wall Street Window is unique in that Mike shows people what he's really investing in and updates you when he buys or sells in his main account. Mike thinks his positions are going to go up because of all the money the Federal Reserve is printing to finance the deficit. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. And Mike's got a great new book coming out, so also keep your eye on writermichaelswanson.com for more details. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org. They've got a brand new website with new and improved access to more than 20 years worth of essays promoting the cause of liberty. And FFF's writers, including Jacob Hornberger, Jim Bovard, Sheldon Richman, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and more, aren't just good. They're the best at opposing and discrediting our corrupt overlords in Washington and their warfare, welfare, regulatory police state. That's the Future Freedom Foundation's new and improved site at FFF.org. The Emergency Committee for Israel, Brookings, Heritage, AIPAC, WINEP, GINSA, PNAC, CNAS, the AEI, FPI, CFR, and CSP. It sure does seem sometimes like the war party's got the foreign policy debate in D.C. all locked up. But not quite. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They put America first, opposing our government's world empire, and especially their Middle Eastern madness. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org.